If it isn't up to C, the original half-man, half-nose will.
Well, Charlie McCarthy, the woodpecker's pin-up boy.
Well, as long as you're here, Bill, you can talk to me while Charlie's getting his hair cut.
You know, Edgar, it's touching to see your affection for the little nipper. It strikes a tender chord in my heart.
Oh, thank you, Bill. You know, I thought you didn't like children.
Oh, not at all, Edgar. I love children. I can remember when, with my own little unsteady legs, I toddled from room to room.
When was that, last night?
Quiet, Wormwood, or I'll whittle you down to a coat hanger.
Yeah.
Tell me, Charles, is it true your father was a gate-leg table?
If it is, your father was under it, or...
Why, you stunted spruce. I'll throw a Japanese beetle on you.
Why, you barfly, you. I'll stick a wick in your mouth and use you for an alcohol lamp without it.
W.C. Fields with Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy. Good afternoon. I'm Jay Pierce. This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. I'm in for Celeste Quinn today. John Dunning has been a glass cutter, a racetrack worker, an investigative reporter for the Denver Post, a teacher of writing at two Denver colleges, the author of eight books, the owner of an antiquarian bookstore, and a radio historian, and talk show host of various Denver radio stations. His own radio library is said to include recordings of 40,000 old-time radio shows. He also provided the soundtrack for the 1973 Robert Altman film Thieves Like Us, scored entirely with old radio shows. And John Dunning is our guest today on the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon, sir.
How are you?
Oh, great.
That was fun listening to that. I've heard it probably 24 times, and it's still funny.
I was going to ask how many times you've listened to that.
Quite a few.
About 20 years ago, you came out with a book called Tune In Yesterday, and now you have... come out with a new book, which is entitled On the Air, the Encyclopedia of Old-Time Radio. And I have to say that over the past couple of weeks, I've been going through this and getting deeper and deeper into it. And I didn't read every word in it because it's about, 800 pages or so.
Yeah.
This has to be, out of everything that I have seen, the definitive history, encyclopedia, whatever you'd like to call it, of old-time radio.
Yeah. Well, I hope it is. If it isn't, I'll tell you, you're going to have to do the next one because I'm done with it now. I mean, you know, when the first one came out, people said the same thing. They said, well, this is kind of the definitive. In fact, the publisher subtitled it The Ultimate Encyclopedia. And almost from the beginning, I started seeing the shortcomings in the book, and this thing was almost called for right away. And over a period of 20 years, I have accumulated this mass of material. And the biggest problem of writing this book, as the editor at Oxford would tell you, Oxford University Press was a publisher this time, that the biggest thing is deciding what not to put in.
It looks like... How could you have left anything out? I can't imagine what you did. But you mean as far as some of the narratives?
Well, you know, my way of writing, and this is true of fiction. I write fiction also, and nonfiction. Is I overwrite it to begin with. In fact, I learned that from John Steinbeck. He wrote something years ago, and he said you put in everything, and then cutting comes later.
Yeah,
and the cutting is the hard part. I turned in a manuscript to Oxford that was 3,600 pages long. I had to send it in a big book box that normally holds 12 or 13 books. And when I looked at my wife, when we put it in the box, I looked at her and I said, my God, the man is going to open the box and he's going to say, I'm dealing with a maniac, and he's going to seal it right up and send it back. And luckily, Oxford is used to handling large books, and he didn't do that. He spent 6 months reading it. And then we spent the next 2 years, I ran the entire 3,600 pages through my typewriter. I write on a manual typewriter, and came up with a very tight 2,200 pages. and that's essentially what was published. They got it into an 850-word page format or something of approaching that.
Yeah, it's about that, including the forward pages and the like. Well, let me ask you, because you are a mystery novelist, Book to Die and The Bookman's Wake, the Cliff Janeway series coming to mind. How did you get into these books on old-time radio?
It's because I'm a very, I guess I'm kind of a romantic, you know. It's part of my life. I remember these shows. Mm-hmm. I remember the ones from about 1949 on through the early to mid-50s. And when you're 7 or 8 years old, the things that happen to you then are the things that stick with you. You just never forget them. And then suddenly, around 1960, I went looking for some of those great radio shows. I abandoned radio along with everybody else when television came out. Never looked back until 1960. I suddenly said, wonder where all those great radio shows were, and they weren't. They were nowhere. The only things on then were Gunsmoke, Suspense, and Yours Truly, Johnny Dollar. That was about it. And then slowly I started hearing that there were actually recordings of some of these things. Even though in the great days of radio, like that excerpt you just played from Charlie McCarthy's show, nothing was recorded. It was all done live. There were mechanisms in place where you could air check a show. So what you just heard was not a recorded show at all. It was a live broadcast that was taken off the air. And that's how it got started. I started listening to these things, picking them up, and gradually accumulated 40,000 shows over a period of 25 years, and this is the result of it.
Wow. They would actually record these. There were services that would record these, and they had back in those days, before tape recorders and DAT machines and everything else that we use today, and computer hard drives, they had basically machines that would cut them into a record.
On a disc.
Yeah, on a disc.
And, you know, this was the era of 78 RPM records at home, so you couldn't play these things at home. You had to have a transcription player, but you could go down to a place like Radio Recorders in Los Angeles, and you could have, if you were Eve Arden and you wanted to save your R. Miss Brooks shows, you could pay to have them recorded off the air. And if you knew an NBC engineer or a CBS engineer, you could have them taken what they call line checks, which were pure, just right off the air. And I'm telling you, when you listen to some of these things today, they're 50, 60 years old, and they sound like you can actually hear them breathe at the microphone. It's wonderful.
The first radio station that I worked at back in 1974 had gone on the air in 1941, I think it was. Yeah, it was about 1941. And they still had some of this equipment in the basement, some of the old stuff. But it was, you know, all mildewed and forgotten long ago next to the old Dr. Pepper machine that, you know, had the crank on it and stuff. But they actually had the record-cutting machine that they used to record commercials on.
Right. It's like a linotype in a newspaper now.
Yeah.
Who uses it?
And some wire recorders, too, that they used to use for things. So I have one of those at home. That's kind of interesting. It has some old stuff on it. But anyway, this radio station, by the way, I don't know if you know it or not, celebrated its 75th anniversary last year. WILLAM went on the air in 1923.
Gosh,
I believe the month was April. So it's rather appropriate to be talking about this on this station, I think.
That is really right in the ballpark with WEAF New York and some of those pioneering stations, WJZ.
Yeah, so I was thinking about going back in the archives here and seeing what we could pull out, but you never know what you'll find in there. But it does make an interesting study to go back and see, you know, what stations did, even on the local level. You know, we all know the network programs, I guess. You know, Art Linkletter had his house party on radio before television. There was the Lone Ranger, there was Gunsmoke, Jack Benny, Amos and Andy, and all the famous programs. But as I was reading, you know, through this encyclopedia over the past week and a half, there are just a plethora of programs that I consider myself to be fairly knowledgeable on this topic, knew nothing about, you know, beyond the Fibber, McGee, and Molly. A program called Ladies Be Seated,
Bob and Ray did a routine, a spinoff on that called Ladies Grab Your Seats.
Which, you know, and there was a program in the 30s, I noticed, Raising Your Parents, which was a forum for kids to talk about problems they had with their parents back in the 1930s when I guess most of us look back and think, boy, you know, the good old days. But apparently there was a need for that then.
And there was a show called, I think it was These Are Our Children or Are These Our Children? And I think they actually did a drama on toilet training. I mean, and that was directed by William N. Robeson, who later did such blood and thunder things like Escape and Gunsmoke. He didn't do Gunsmoke, but he did Suspense. A lot of those kind of shows. Did a story, a 30-minute story on the consequences of toilet training. Radio was great. I'm telling you, everything, literally everything, was on the air.
And there was the program from San Quentin Prison, Quentin on the air, where they actually originated a radio program from the prison, from a stage in the prison.
Yeah. That was a very creative show. Convicts, I guess, by the nature of them, have to be creative, don't they?
Yeah, I would suppose. And this was long before Johnny Cash did his concerts there.
Right? The announcer was a convict, all the writers were, the musicians, everybody.
Wow.
They nicknamed it Harmonies in the Hooskow.
There was another program on that reminds me of the Newlywed Game. It was back in the early 50s, and here it was called Rate Your Mate, See How Much You Know About Your Spouse. Interesting.
A lot of the things you see on television were derivative. They derived from radio, like Blind Date with Arlene Francis, which, you know, where you'd have servicemen who would talk to women, actresses and so forth, on the other side of a partition, and the actress would try to engage the guy in conversation and then pick which one she wanted to go out with that night. I think that later became, what did they call it on television?
Dating Game?
Dating Game, something like that.
Exactly.
Even Rod Serling on The Twilight Zone. Uh-huh. When I looked at some of the repeats, I could see influences of radio shows like Escape and Suspense.
Yeah. One, the public television viewers, and we do have a phone call we'll get to in just a moment. One, the public television viewers might be interested in, back in the 1940s, Hercule Poirot, the Agatha Christie series, was on radio before coming to public television, you know, that we enjoy now.
I think you'll find that almost everything was on radio. Yeah. Perry Mason was on radio as a soap opera, no less. Philo Vance was on radio, almost all of those detectives. And, of course, The Adventures of Sam Spade was nothing like what Hammett created. Howard Duff, who played the lead, made Sam Spade his own creation.
Let's take a telephone call. By the way, our telephone numbers are 333-9455 if you're in the Champaign-Urbana area, and toll-free outside the immediate metro area, 1-800-222-9455, or WILL if you... can find the letters on the phone easier, or remember it easier. 1-800-222-9455 or in town, 333-9455. And John Dunning is our guest. His new book is On the Air, The Encyclopedia of Old Time Radio. We'll go to line four first. Hi, where are you calling from?
Tannerville.
And you're on the air with John Dunn.
Hi,
how
Mr.
are you?
Dunning. I have two special memories. Of course, I have scores, hundreds of others, but I'd like to regale you with these, and maybe you're familiar with them. There was an Inner Sanctum program that knocked my socks off when I was a kid. I understood the romance of mystery and the extraordinary show. It was about this motorist who was... driving somewhere on presumably an important errand, and he kept running into this hitchhiker, this woman, and picking her up, and somehow there was trouble between them, and he'd put her out, and he'd find her down the road further, and it got more and more serious and desperate, their differences. This has been 50 years at least since I heard this thing, and finally he's trying to kill her, but he can't kill her because she's the ghost of his wife that he murdered in Stardust.
Like
I seem to remember was their song.
Right.
Then you know that one?
No, as to my knowledge, that show has not turned up, but it sounds so much like the kind of things Inner Sanctum did, and the way he got away with that was exactly what you're talking about, where where he would put you inside the mind of a killer, but and then the guy would start seeing a ghost. When you started talking about a hitchhiker, I thought you were going to be talking about the suspense show that Orson Welles did, called The Hitchhiker, which was a gripping, incredible program.
Yeah, I'm familiar with that. There was this Jack Benny thing, those programs that where he had dreams and or nightmares were special. I really believe he had cornered the writing market for comedy because his program was head and shoulders, even above the likes of people like Fred Allen. I wonder, this Benny show, they did a number on old wagon train caravan going to California. Uh-huh. And Dennis Day, I think, played this old geezer who every so often would rear back and say, "I'm a dying, I'm a sinking fast, I'll never live to see California."
Gee, you should have been on radio. You're pretty good.
He just was.
But, he just was. But, you know, he's right about the Benny Show. It was absolutely wonderful. It's timeless, and I listened to 600 or 800 of them, and I still marvel at the timing of the crew and the writing. From the time that those four writers, Milt Josephsberg, Sam Perrin, and George Balzer and John Tackerberry came in 1943, that the humor just became wonderful.
Yeah, I would cite Mencken though on old time radio. He was he was a little bit narrow minded in some respects. He said the radio in a conversation with James Farrell, they're all morons. I would say it was more like 90% of them. Those soap operas, and for example that Lights Out series. I thought that was one of the dumbest horror shows on old radio. You'd have some woman or women who were terrorized, and half the show would be their whimpering, gibbering noises about proving how frightened they were. It seemed to me, even as a kid, I thought it was almost criminally stupid. And most of old time radio was, let's face it, garbage.
Anything that's put out for public consumption is appeals to a lowest common denominator. But there were things in radio that just stood up and just rose up. I mean, it's like television today. If you watch a show like Homicide, which I think is the best thing that's been done on TV, that'll assure its downfall. I'm sure they'll cancel it this year. But things like I'll Fly Away, those things are just so wonderful. NBC ought to hang its head in shame today for canceling that show. But of course, they're awash in a sea of junk. You know, that's the way it goes.
That's the way the media goes.
Yeah, it is.
You put it out there, and some of it catches, some of it doesn't. And we thank the caller from Taylorville very much. We do have another caller to move on to here, John. 333-9455 is our Metro number, and 1-800-222-9455 from outside the Champaign-Urbana area. This caller's on line one. Good afternoon.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
I had a question about a show that I remember. I remember listening to Duffy's Tavern regularly 50 years ago, and just as a kid being enthralled with the story that went on. And I can remember one particular New Year's Eve program. I can't remember the entire story anymore, but it seems to be a mystical magic story that I thought about a lot years later. I was wondering, is there any place on the Internet where you can access scripts or audios of any of these programs to look at them again?
Man, you know, I'll tell you, the Internet is a mystery to me. That's why I write on a manual typewriter. I can barely turn a computer on, and I know that there is a lot of stuff on the Internet. You guys are close to Chicago, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't be surprised if Chuck Shaden, who does a show up there, is listening or might know. You might call somebody like that. He has a store in Chicago called Metro-Goldwyn-Memories, and Chuck might know. I think he's more of a computer guy than I am.
Yeah, you can actually find more about his store and stuff on the Internet. If you go any search engine, you know, like Yahoo, go into Yahoo and put in old-time radio, and you'll just come up with thousands of listings.
Old-time radio.
Yeah. Just
the chances of you finding an individual show. That's why when the gentleman a minute ago was asking me about a particular Inner Sanctum, I mean, you got to remember that there were hundreds of those shows done, and of the Inner Sanctum shows, I think only about 100 have turned up so far. And And the chances that even somebody like me who has spent a long time studying radio will know an individual episode. I mean, everybody has their own episode. I remember an episode of The Shadow that just scared me so badly at 7 that I couldn't sleep for in an unlighted room for weeks. And the shadow, a scarecrow was going around doing these murders. And right at the end, when the shadow unmasks him and rips the coat off, there's nothing but straw underneath. You know, the implication of that, that the scarecrow was actually real, this murderous thing, I just was terrified by it.
Can you remember any particular stories or what the gist of the storyline for all of the old Duffy's Taverns were?
Duffy's Tavern was the kind of show that didn't usually have that much of a storyline. It was more like Fibber McGee and Molly in the sense that they had a series of gags that were set in this tavern down in lower New York. And there was a story in the sense that there was a thrust to it, but it wasn't a situation comedy like The Life of Riley or Ozzie and Harriet or something like that. It all centered around usually a guest was going to come into the tavern, and Ed Gardner, who played the role of Archie, the barkeep, would insult this guy for 30 minutes with some of the most hilarious jokes at the guest's expense that you ever heard. It was a very creative and funny show.
Okay. And I'll hang up and listen, but would you talk about some of the old soaps like Argyle Sunday and Ma Perkins and so forth?
Sure.
Thanks.
Sure. We can get into that. We do have some more phone calls. Duffy's Tavern, where the elite meet to eat.
Yep. Archie the manager speaking. Duffy ain't here. That was the opening line.
And one of the characters who was on that went on to television. It's interesting to mention some of this because it gives a frame of reference to younger listeners who didn't live in the golden age of radio and may have seen Hazel on television. But I believe one of the characters in Duffy's Tavern was indeed Shirley Booth.
Shirley Booth was married to Ed Gardner.
Is that right?
Yeah, and in fact, her career was in full bloom, and when he was pretty much a behind the scenes radio hustler, and then when he created Duffy's Tavern, it really took off, and he needed a Brooklyn voice to play Miss Duffy. She was Duffy himself was never heard. He was just an unheard mm-hmm. voice on the telephone.
Yeah.
And Shirley Booth played Miss Duffy, who was his daughter, a real airhead, but a perfect Brooklyn voice. And then she left after they got divorced around 1943 or something like that, and he went through a succession of Miss Duffy's, maybe 11 of them, looking for that perfect voice and never quite found it again.
John Dunning is our guest on the Afternoon Magazine today. His book is On the Air, The Encyclopedia of Old-Time Radio. It's put out by Oxford University Press. Let's go to line 2. You're on the air.
Hi. I have a more technical question that I hope you haven't answered already. I once heard Willard Waterman being interviewed 10 or 15 years ago, and he was regretting the fact that they didn't have a permanent taping of his show, The Great Gildersleeve, and how much they could do with it if they only had those tapes, and yet I'm happy to say I hear that show often on Chuck Shaden on the weekend or the Stan Freberg one-hour presentation on WMAQ. So what is the sort of, what proportion of the shows still live?
Quite a few. The show is almost solid from the beginning. It started in August, I think, 1941. Hal Perry was the first Gildersleeve.
Right.
He was
right.
The one that originated it on Fibber McGee and Molly. In fact,
right.
Gildersleeve was the first series spinoff. And Perry played it up until 1949 when he began to get tired of it. And Waterman's voice was so incredibly like Perry's that they didn't miss a beat. I mean, and that transition time is complete, too. You can get tapes of the the last Perry show when they went off for the summer, and then the first Waterman show. And the major difference was that Perry was an accomplished singer. And if you listen to the Perry shows, you'll hear a lot of the Jolly Boys Club harmonizing, and then Perry will take a solo, and he was really had quite a voice, and Waterman didn't do that, and he didn't do the dirty laugh that Perry did at the beginning of each show. He did more of a chortle, in a way.
Is this same sort of complete coverage true of many other of the more popular half-hour comedies or even the drama ones in that period?
Not so much. Fibber McGee and Molly is fairly solid. Lum and Abner is remarkably. I mean, there's a place in Dora, Alabama called the National Lum and Abner Society, and And there's 1,500 near consecutive Lemon Abner chapters. Amos and Andy is pretty good. There's a couple of seasons in the early 40s, and then there's some stuff toward the end of the run that pretty well shores that show up. But there's a lot of shows, like the Kate Smith Hour, which is not comedy, but it was variety, and virtually none of them at all.
Well, thank you for bringing back some fond memories.
Uh-huh.
Thank you much for your call. Sounds like our ring at the Jot 'em Down store. Lemon Abner. I love that series. That's one of my favorites. And that has been, golly, the station in Southern Illinois used to run that every day at 12:30.
Yeah,
and,
during
lunch.
It's still good.
Be out in the car listening to that. We, by way of information, run the classic Bob and Ray series on Sunday evenings on our FM station, WILL-FM. At 90.9 and 101.1 in Champaign-Urbana as a part of the Sunday Evening Theater. And that's on, I believe, 8:30 is the time, if I'm not mistaken. Sometime between 8 and 9 o'clock. Yeah. You know, they're timeless classics. That's a pretty good series, too. There is, at various times the interest goes up and down in some of the old time radio. I think it's kind of, at least my impression, tell me if I'm wrong, is that we're at an increased level of interest in going back and listening. I know we've mentioned Chuck Shaden's program. He's been in Chicago on various radio stations doing old time radio for a long time, and then there's the syndicated program that Stan Freberg does that airs on WMAQ in Chicago, which I believe is kind of a, I don't know, I seem to think the Stan Freberg program was one that Chuck Shaden did to begin with, and then Stan Freberg did that, and Chuck went on and did another program.
Yeah, Freberg, I think, narrates a syndicated series that's put out by a fellow named Carl Amari.
Ah.
The problem is that Freberg is particularly un-Freeberg-like on that show. He sounds like just another announcer. And if you miss the opening where he said, "This is Stan Freberg," you don't know who's talking.
Yeah, I thought he
sounded. You have no idea who he is.
Yeah, a little scripted. Let's go to line four see who's there. Where are you calling from? Line four.
Is this line four?
Yeah, you're
all right. I'm calling from Danville.
From Danville. Okay, you're on the air.
And I am one of those who came home from school and listened to Jack Armstrong and send in for a magic decoding ring for the secret message at the end of a program.
You still have
and,
it? I hope you kept that, because those are really worth some money now.
Well, I'm afraid not. But, first of all, I must say how much I enjoyed your mysteries. They are truly great and informative about the book publishing and the typesetting business.
Well, thank you.
My question, however, I think I had read someplace that there was a governmental department, perhaps the Department of Agriculture, that sponsored some sort of homemaking informative programs for nutrition and so on. Can you recall any of those from the 30s?
There was a show called Our Daily Food that was on in the early 30s, and then, Aunt Sammy's Recipes was one of the very early shows.
I think that's the one I read about. I had not heard any of those shows.
Well, Aunt Sammy started around 1927, I think, and that was kind of unusual because what they did was they sent out scripts to different stations, and they had a different actress in every market, or they didn't call them markets then, in every city that impersonated Aunt Sammy.
Oh, Uncle Sam's wife, I take it.
Right. And she would give homemaking tips and tell you how to cook things, and of course that's a very well-known show now.
And had it lasted quite a long time, or?
I think it went from about 1927 into the Depression, because in those days, it was very important to make the most out of what you cooked, you know. And she helped you with that.
Yes. Now, you're talking about old stations. I think WHA in Madison, Wisconsin is one of the oldest, is it not?
I don't know.
Same
time
as KDKA in Pittsburgh?
KDKA was the first station.
Commercial station, right.
Yeah. There were a lot of experimental stations. In fact, I think there was one in Detroit that actually broadcast some primary results a few weeks before KDKA signed on the air. And then in New York, WEAF, WOR, WJZ, these were real pioneering stations in the early 20s.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
Well, it's been a joy to talk with you.
Well, thank you.
Thanks so much.
We have, quite a bit of radio history in this area, because right down the street, over the interstate a little bit, in Decatur was the first station in Illinois, WDZ, which is still on the air. Uh-huh. Originally went on the air in Tuscola and moved over to Decatur. And there's a station down in the southern part of the state, another station that went on the air very early in the 1920s. In fact, I think the WDZ in Decatur went on the air in 1921.
Mm.
And has been on continuously. So.
And there are stations like you mentioned, WMAQ. That has a long and vivid history. They were doing some great things like Destination Freedom back in the late 40s.
Yeah, they were actually, Chicago originated a lot of the network programs, didn't they?
Yeah. Well, Chicago was in the mid-30s, was the biggest hub of radio in the country.
Yeah.
I mean, bigger than New York even. And then around 1939, the big tide to the West Coast began. Agencies began opening offices down on Vine Street, and you had, because that was the mecca of Hollywood then, and the stars were all available for radio, and it just seemed to bloom overnight.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have a lot more phone calls to get to, and let's just go right to the lines. Line one now. You're on the air with John Dunning.
Oh, good. Good afternoon.
Hi.
I remember the great Gildersleeve and Fibber McGee and Molly.
Uh-huh.
And my favorite character, I think, of any of them back there was Digger Duggar, the friendly undertaker.
Digger O'Dell. He was
on Digger
the Life of Riley.
Oh, Digger O'Dell. I'm a shovel off.
Yep. He was on the Life of Riley.
Oh, was that what it was?
Yeah.
I got such a kick out of his vocabulary and everything.
The guy who played Digger O'Dell was a man named John Brown, who was... I think he was drummed off the air in the witch hunting days of the McCarthy era, the Blacklist. I think he was always reading the Daily Worker or something. This is what I heard. And John Brown was a very versatile actor. He also played Ozzie Nelson's neighbor, Thorny. And Ozzie was one of the ones who would not knuckle under to the congressional inquisitors. He refused to fire these guys, and John Brown in his Digger O'Dell voice, Riley would be going along and suddenly he would come upon Digger O'Dell, and his first line was always, "Hello, Riley, you're looking fine, very natural." and then, of course, like you said, at the end he would say, "So long, I'd better be shoveling off." And there were always a lot of death jokes, and the producer of that show was very skittish about creating a character who was an undertaker, because he didn't know death is always an uncomfortable subject back then. You couldn't have a show of somebody dying of cancer. Yeah, when they were dying of a disease, you never mentioned what it was, but the undertakers loved it when he came on.
Thank you very much to the caller. Let's move on to line two now, if we might. Line two, you're on the air with John Dunning. Hello.
Hi. All these years, I've been wanting to track down the actors in Jack Armstrong, especially Mason Adams and Jim and Don Ameche.
Mm-hmm.
Did the two Ameches used to alternate?
No, the Jim Ameche played Jack Armstrong, I believe, from the beginning in 1933, and Don Ameche played the part of, I think the fellow's name was Captain Hughes, who was an adult presence in that show, until he became kind of a leading man and left Chicago for Hollywood in the mid-30s.
Yeah. Well, their voices are identical.
Uh-huh.
Now, tell me what happened to Mason Adams.
I think he's still around.
Well, there was a big... long hiatus. He had a very distinctive voice. What character did he play?
He played Pepper Young on Pepper Young's Family.
Yeah, yeah. And I didn't hear from him for years and years, and now he's back on the air.
Yeah, yeah.
He was the most recent thing I saw him in was the television show with Lou Grant. The Lou Grant, wasn't that what it was called?
The
newspaper after the Mary Tyler Moore series, Ed Asner had his own series, and Mason Adams was editor, publisher,
yeah,
something.
Right.
He wasn't
and
the publisher, but I think he was like the managing editor.
I think he did some of the CBS radio mystery theaters that Hyman Brown put on.
Yeah, I heard the voice. And
and Schmucker's jelly commercials.
Mm. Okay. But for a century, that guy was missing.
Huh.
Well, now we found him.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot.
There you go. Thank you much for the call. You're listening to the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 WILL. My name's Jay Pierce. We're talking with John Dunning, author of On the Air, the Encyclopedia of Old-Time Radio, put out by Oxford University Press. And let's move on to Line 3. Line 3, you're on the air with John Dunning. Good afternoon.
Yeah, well, still has Smuckers on. I wanted to mention, I lived far enough north in my younger days that we got radio from the Canadian National Railroad line. But in 1939-1940, before the United States went into World War II, in Canada we got the the world would be like if the Nazis took over. And this happened on Sunday night. Invariably, I would have been sent to bed. We had central heating with the three heat registers in one corner of the bedrooms upstairs. And I would fall asleep listening to these jackboots come down the hall. And probably it must have been done by the BBC, because I don't imagine them doing it in Canada, but it was our duty to be aware of the Nazi menace. And I just wondered if you'd heard any of that, or to bring it to your attention.
Well, didn't you get a lot of American radio in Canada? I mean, United States radio?
Yeah, we got up until, well, no, we got everything until 10 o'clock.
Uh-huh.
Just exactly the same as it was here. We got Jack Benny, and then there was a Lux Radio Theater Hour,
mm-hmm,
and Grand Central Station on Saturday morning.
The only show that comes to my mind is a story that Arch Obler wrote called Chicago, Germany. And that was done about 1939, and it was about what would happen if the Nazis took over, if the Germans had won the war.
I'll bet that's the one, then, because there wasn't any British accent.
Uh-huh.
So I bet that's it. Thanks.
It's called Chicago, Germany, and Betty Davis, I think, was in it. And Obler was the writer and director of that. He's the same guy that wrote Lights Out, which your former listener didn't care much about.
Yeah, well, it scared the heck out of a six-year-old boy.
That's what it was supposed to do.
Yeah. Hey, thanks.
Uh-huh.
What is, John, what is your, before we go to the next phone call, what's your favorite program?
You know, I'm always asked that, and mm-hmm, I would have to give you about 20 shows. I just... The Jack Benny Show is certainly, and the Phil Harris Alice Faye Show are two of the greatest comedies, and they're so different from shows like Destination Freedom, which I think was a groundbreaking performance and an amazing show. Gunsmoke was a great show. Frontier Gentlemen was a great show. I think one of my favorite shows of all was Kathy and Elliot Lewis on Stage. I think that was a time, 1954. When radio was just beginning to change from the old ways into what it was going to become if television hadn't come along and killed it. They did some amazingly grown-up theater of the mind, as they called it then.
Yeah. Radio became more and more canned after that, as the term goes, I guess, as television took a lot of the live performance and drama and creativity with it. Probably better exposure, more money. You know, I suppose were some of the reasons.
Absolutely.
That
Information Police is another one that I just love. It's a great show.
We have three callers on the line, and that's probably all we'll be able to take before we have to wrap things up. This hour has gone very, very quickly. Let's go to line number one, and you're on the air, line one, with John Dunning.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. I have a question. Theater of the Mind. Since learned, as you said, that it was a general term for radio, but in the would have been late 40s, early 50s, I heard three broadcasts of a show I thought was called Theater of the Mind. They did a dramatization of who wrote Shakespeare. Someone is discussing it. The Shade of Shakespeare appears and says, well, of course I wrote Shakespeare. And then other people like I believe Christopher Marlowe start showing up claiming they did, and he loses his temper, and Shakespeare says, you see why he was killed in a duel. There was a dramatization of 1984 and of Brave New World, and then the program disappeared. It was my favorite show, and I was never able to find it again.
Yeah, I think the show you're talking about is the CBS Radio Workshop, and they opened that show with Brave New World. Aldous Huxley was the narrator on that, and William Frug, that's F-R-O-U-G, who was a producer, claimed to me, and I used it in the book, that he originated that phrase, theater of the mind, and so I gave him credit for it. I've never heard of it actually being said earlier than that. That would have been ranked, that's a little bit later than what you remember it. That would have been in 1956.
Uh-huh. Well, it may have been that late.
Uh-huh.
But as I say, I love the program, and I could never find it again.
It was a great show, and they did do a Shakespeare show on there. They did a show where Shakespeare is interviewed.
Uh-huh.
And that's the series you're talking about.
Yes.
Great. Thank you very much for the call. It's great when these memories come back like this from the telephone callers. Let's go to line two. Hi, you're on the air, line two, with John Dunning.
Hello.
Hi.
I can remember when I was young, a program, I think it was by the linguist Leonard Bloomfield, in which he would identify where people were from, I think largely operating in the East, by state, by county, their background sometimes. Do you know if any of those are still available?
Was that a national show? Was it a network show?
I heard it in Kansas City, and I think it was coming out of the East Coast, because he lived in the East.
I tell you, you got me on that one. I don't know it, and it might have been a regional show, or it might have been one of those kind of things, but
yeah.
I just don't know.
Yeah, okay, thanks.
Uh-huh.
Bye.
All right, let's wrap things up with our caller on line four. Hi, line four. Where are you calling from, please?
I'm calling from Aurora, Illinois.
From Aurora, up near mm-hmm. Chicago. All right,
yes.
You're on the air with John Dunning.
Yes,
hi.
Thank you. What I wanted to know is I'm interested in the old Beulah. I don't know, did you speak on that already? On the old Beulah series?
Uh-huh.
Are you familiar with that?
Oh, absolutely. Beulah was a character that originated on Fibber McGee and Molly when...
Did she really?
Well, she was a he. There was a fellow named Marlon Hurt who had an ability to speak with a kind of a falsified female voice, and he would always be introduced by Fibber with his back to the microphone, and when Fibber would say, "Hey, Beulah, Beulah," and he would whirl and say, "Somebody call for Beulah," and the audience would just go nuts when they saw that this was a white man doing the part of a black woman.
Well, how many characters actually played that? I know Louise Beaver, I think, was one.
Well, Hattie McDaniel played it once, but the first two who played it were white men. A fellow named Bob Corley played it, and I think it started as a novelty item, the fact that a white man could play a black
uh-huh.
woman. And Beulah was kind of a happy-go-lucky maid in the McGee household.
Right.
And then she became her own series, and
right.
then Marlon Hurt had a heart attack and died.
Okay.
And they tried to recast it, and that's when they got Bob Corley to do it. And then they had, I know there was Hattie McDaniel, who you'll remember mm-hmm. from Gone with the Wind,
right.
did it for a while. And finally, one of the ladies from Amos and Andy, it finally wound up where it was supposed to be, with a black woman playing the role
okay.
of a black woman.
Okay, do you know the years that, you know?
Well, it started in 45. The character came around 1944 on the Fibber McGee show, and then started as its own series around 1945, and then it was intermittent. And in the early 50s, I think Hattie McDaniel was playing it. And then for a while it was what they call a strip show, where they were doing a 15-minute show once a day.
Oh, yes. Oh, I remember those, yes, when I was
uh-huh.
a child. Yes, and then it went on TV, and, oh, wow.
Yeah, it would have been hard to do it on TV with a white man.
No, she did it on TV. Oh, boy, well, thank you. But is there a place that you can go and find all the minority radio programs, or are they included in what you're...
Boy, there weren't many of them, I'll tell you.
Mm-hmm.
The blacks in radio...
were really given short shrift. I mean, I think I used the term, it was a white actor's playground in those days. Even on Destination Freedom, I interviewed some of the white actors who played the supporting roles, and they said that before that show came on, there wasn't one single part that they could think of where blacks were used in anything other than roles of burlesque or toadies or exaggerated black dialect.
Yeah.
They never did do serious stuff before that.
Hmm. Thank you much to the caller. And, John, we have to wrap things up. Boy, this hour's gone quickly.
It sure has.
When you get talking, with a lot of great callers and sharing memories and getting some questions answered, it's great.
They were all good.
Yeah, and thank you very much for joining us and making this possible with your book, On the Air, the Encyclopedia of Old-Time Radio. You know, old-time radio enthusiasts, Christmas time is coming up.
Yep. Well, thanks a lot.
The Oxford University Press is who published this.